WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Greetings and welcome to WrestleSpective. I am Jason Mann. Before we begin, I'll tell you a little bit about our sponsor, RotoReels.com. It's a great way to get downloads and DVDs of professional wrestling from the U.S., Mexico, Japan, pretty much anywhere in which there's professional wrestling, you can get it there. So check out RotoReels.com. And I welcome my guest today. He is a first-time guest on WrestleSpective. Luke Starr. Luke, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm really a huge fan of WrestleSpective Radio, so really happy to be a part of this.
All right. Well, glad to have you. And today we are going to talk about the 1993 Royal Rumble match. Find WWE in a state of transition, sort of from the old guard to the new generation, led by Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, and others. So this is definitely kind of smack dab in the middle of that, and sort of a very interesting time of transition for them.
Yeah, I think it's extremely interesting. I think around this time, 92 going into 93, feels like a really interesting transitional period, sort of like some growing pains for the company at the time. So
definitely, and they definitely cut back their talent pool and stopped doing a lot of the house shows. It was in the midst of WWE undergoing scrutiny for the steroid issues that they were having, the scandal, and eventual trial of Vince McMahon would have to face in 93 and 94, so on and so forth. Yeah, they kind of out of nowhere in late 92 decided to put the WWE title on Bret Hart at a house show in Saskatoon, beating Ric Flair. So that was a big surprise. Bret had certainly, you know, been Intercontinental Champion and was certainly, you know, getting pushed, but he certainly wasn't expected to be the number one guy. It wasn't like it was a definite thing or by any means. Yokozuna had just debuted and would be a big part of this Rumble. Ultimate Warrior and Davey Boy Smith had been fired for or left the company out of there were some steroid allegations there with them. WWF had just started testing, I believe, at the end of 92. So it started their first steroid testing program. So Hulk Hogan had been gone since WrestleMania. He'd make a brief comeback and a little bit from here, but he was almost essentially done with WWE. And Ric Flair was about on its way out. So definitely, you know, going from the old guys to the new guys. Randy Savage, who had been champion for a lot of 92, was kind of being phased out into a part-time role and doing announcing. And so just a lot of stuff like that.
Yeah. And actually, it's interesting you mentioned Hogan's role in the company and how diminished it was. I think throughout this broadcast, there was barely any mention of Hogan. And that's something that you know, even at the time, seemed a little odd. It still felt like, even though they were transitioning away from Hogan at the time, he still dominated, you know, almost every broadcast to this point.
Well, he was, I don't know if they were mentioning him as much on TV, but he was definitely like he was still the number one guy most people thought of when they thought of WWF, even though, you know, like you said, he wasn't there. But yeah, you know, it wasn't essentially, right. I don't think they were sure yet that he was going to come back. He came back, I think, about a month and a half later. So, and did the WrestleMania tag match and then won the title in the Bret Hart Yokozuna match, which this obviously led to. So, so let's get into it. We're in Sacramento, California. The Rumble card itself has a, It has the other main events of the show, the big matches, Razor Ramon against Bret Hart, who, you know, Razor was a guy who hadn't been around for that long as well.
Right.
He was a guy who came around in late 92 and kind of was thrown into the mix with he was kind of thrown into the mix with Flair for a while, and he and Flair wrestled Mr. Perfect and Randy Savage at Survivor Series. So he was kind of thrown into the mix pretty quickly. Shawn Michaels and Marty Jannetty had their first big singles match. It had been a year since the Shawn Michaels had turned on Marty Jannetty, so that was kind of a big feud. Although this match was really disappointing to me. We have Bam Bam Bigelow, who'd kind of come back in and beat the Big Boss Man, who was kind of on his way out, would be headed to WCW later in 93. The Steiner brothers had come in. They had just made their debut in WWF and were on a tag match on this show. So, you know, as you can see, just transitioning to the new talent, some of it coming from WCW, some of it, you know, homegrown or whatever. And it was a dark match, but Doink the Clown also made his pay-per-view debut beating Jim Powers in this match. So Doink, a important and fun character for most of the that evil clown thing was a pretty it was interesting, you know, just the kind of the comedy, or not really, I guess not really comedy, but the goofy character who could also wrestle very well effectively was just kind of an interesting interesting mix. So our number one is Ric Flair, who was, as we said, just about on his way out in the company. In fact, he and Mr. Perfect had a Loser Leaves Town match scheduled for the next Raw. And this was that was like the second or third Raw that the WWE ever had. They just started Monday Night Raw, transitioning it from primetime wrestling. So this marks the first time in which any wrestling company had hyped what was going to be happening the next night on their pay-per-view. So.
Oh, that's an interesting tidbit. Yeah,
historic moment. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I assume so. Certainly it was the first time that anyone ever hyped Raw. So.
Right. Right.
I do love, we have Bobby Heenan and Gorilla Monsoon on commentary, who were always classic on pay-per-views. I think best remembered for their 92 commentary with Ric Flair being in the Rumble for 60 minutes and Bobby Heenan being over the top about everything. Attack Flair. So it's kind of nice. As soon as Flair's music hits, Heenan is like, oh no, not again.
Yeah, it was actually kind of really nice to see how emotionally invested Heenan was in Flair's performance even this year. You know, it was a nice nod to their history. He was really all in on everything Flair did throughout this Rumble.
Right. So, and then number two is Bob Backlund, who doesn't have music. And there's a point in which they don't do music for the entrances for the Rumble. Only Flair got it just because he was, you know, the first one. But he does not get much reaction coming out here because he had come back in late 92. They kind of showed clips of, you know, they get into the backstory about him losing the title to the Iron Sheik at the end of 83. And then basically disappearing for almost 10 years. And really he did. It was sort of inexplicable that Backlund had been such a big star and then 6 months later meant almost nothing and then was gone from wrestling for you know, that amount of time. He did sort of I think he briefly was in AWA and he briefly did the Pro Wrestling USA, which was kind of the big attempt by the AWA and the NWA promotions to run some shows in New York territory as sort of opposition to Vince, that sort of fell apart when none of the people would agree. And Backlund kind of got some, my understanding is that Backlund did do okay in the Northeast during this time, at least getting a reaction from the crowd, but the other crowds just really didn't know him or didn't care much about him because Backlund, you know, let's face it, kind of a weird guy.
Oh, definitely. Weird character, weird look. I think his style, even, you know, returning in the 90s was, yeah, it was definitely a bit odd.
Yeah, it was just kind of archaic. He was sort of like the, you know, he harkened back to like a 60s or 70s style wrestler, doing a lot of amateur type things. But it wasn't just that his style, it was more just like he just had really weird facial expression. He seemed like a bit of a silly guy. So it was just interesting. And they call saying that he's making a tremendous comeback at age 43. And as far as I can remember, Backlund is the only wrestler in WWE from like the, you know, early 80s to this point, really into the late 90s, that I can ever remember the commentators referring to him by a specific age.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if I remember that happening either at that time. I thought it was a bit, well, not odd, but it was interesting to hear that during this event.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and that was obviously like part of his story, but it's just really weird for to hear that, because that was never anything I ever really considered was wrestlers' real ages. Growing up, it just wasn't something they talked about, and it was just not something that didn't occur to me. I mean, if I had known Bret Hart's real age was in fact, when I found out Bret Hart's real age more in the like toward 97 after he left Montreal, they were like, yeah, he's 40 and he's a 20-year veteran, trying to make him seem old. I was like, wow, I can't believe Bret's that old, you know. But it makes sense, the guy's around for that long, you know. You just don't think of, at least at the time, I didn't really ever think of real wrestlers' ages. It just wasn't something that was anything that was made a big deal about. Now, they don't really get into it that much today, unless like when The Rock won the title or when Randy Orton won the title, they made big deals about them being the youngest WWE champions of all time and stuff like that. But for the most part, it's not, ages aren't really brought up now as much, but you will get kind of the occasional mention. It's not quite the hush-hush taboo thing that it used to be.
Yeah, I feel that, you know, what was interesting is the fact that, like, such a like his specific age, like 43, like that, I think the number kind of hit me. You know, usually age is, you know, communicated through just like personality. You get like the Rockers, for example, like they're young and they're fun. But hearing someone's specific age was, yeah, a bit out of the ordinary.
Yeah. So Backlund comes in. He offers Flair a handshake, but does the old fake the handshake, run his hand through his hair routine. Then they lock up. Backlund shoulder blocks him down, and there's like a really funny hopping type dance. My 3-year-old daughter would do. And he does another shoulder block and a couple of knee trips and then some more funny dancing.
Right.
So Flair's overmatched a little bit at first. Then he gets the classic eye gouge, works him over in the corner for a bit. Then Backlund gets a backdrop and a big atomic drop, which used to be his finisher of all things. Although he does it dramatically enough where he holds it and then he gets the guy down pretty forcefully in the thing, where you can kind of see where it's bigger than the typical lazy atomic drop that you see most of the time nowadays and you know, even these days.
Right, yeah. It's a high impact atomic drop, I guess.
It's a little bit more forceful than your average atomic drop. So yeah. Flair flops on that. And then number three, we have Papa Shango. For those who don't know, Papa Shango is also the wrestler who later became the Godfather. And he was a voodoo character, probably best known for putting a curse on the Ultimate Warrior and the Ultimate Warrior vomiting on camera. I think around 92-ish. Yeah, it would have been within the last, you know, previous 6 months to a year they did that, sometime after WrestleMania 8 when Warrior came back. So, but really was pretty much being phased out at this point. And as we can see, he kicks Backlund in the back, works him over for a tiny bit, gets a series of headbutts, but then Flair sneaks from behind and eliminates him right away. So less than a minute in.
Yeah, made short work of Papa Shango. It seemed like, you know, some potentially big things were happening for the character in 92, but yeah, it was phased out fairly quickly.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously he's remembered mostly for that silly thing, but
yeah.
I mean, I think the character was at least like something different, something interesting. You know, it's creative anyway. You know, you got to give it that. You got to give them props for trying something different, at least.
Yeah, definitely.
So Flair tries to throw over Backlund, but Backlund lands on the apron. And then Gorilla brings up the fact that Backlund was able to show a lot of feats of strength in the past. He was known for a guy with really good conditioning and really a lot of strength, even though he doesn't really look particularly well conditioned or strong. It was more of a like Flair's also a really well conditioned guy, but you never thought of Flair as having a really good physique, but it's more cardiovascular conditioning rather than the type of bodybuilding conditioning that makes you look good cosmetically but may not make you as, you know, cardiovascularly as strong, if that's a word.
Yeah, that's a word. Yeah, that was interesting. I think, seems like things like that have to be explicitly stated when you look at a guy like Bob Backlund. It's not something you would ever even really guess that he would be known for feats of strength.
And there, I mean, it's kind of trying to put over the idea that even though Backlund and Flair are the first two guys, that maybe they could last. I mean, obviously Flair has proven it before, and then saying, well, Backlund, you know, was a guy who could go for a long time and, you know, was impressive. So that kind of makes sense. Then sends Flair into the corner, and Flair begs off on Backlund's attack. That leads us to number four, who is Ted DiBiase, who comes out with Jimmy Hart, which always was weird to see Ted DiBiase with Jimmy Hart. I just don't know. I guess because Ted DiBiase dressed in like the black and like the basic stuff, and then Jimmy Hart was all gaudy. And I think of like Ted DiBiase as a guy who is more of like he has his own stable. Like even as a wrestler, I mean, he had Virgil most of the time. He had Andre for a while. Like he and IRS were, you know, a tag team for a long while before they ever had a manager. It just seemed weird for DiBiase to be a guy who needed a manager.
Yeah, it seems odd to me too. And it seems like, perhaps this is just something to really build that I guess feud with Hogan and Beefcake, but it strikes me as odd to see Jimmy Hart out there with DiBiase, definitely.
Because the whole story was Jimmy Hart, he was managing the Nasty Boys, and then I guess Money Incorporated got a title shot ahead of the Nasty Boys, which led to the Nasty Boys getting mad at Jimmy and then turning face. And then a little bit later in the kind of Hogan's comeback is led because DiBiase and IRS attack Bruce Beefcake and smash his face with I think DiBiase has some sort of case with money in it or something like that, and that sort of and Jimmy Hart tries to prevent him from doing it, and then he turns into a good guy too, which Jimmy Hart is a good guy, also not a thing that I ever could believe. He just seemed like the whiniest, most obnoxious guy ever. Like, why would anyone think
Yeah.
he was a good guy? And so him being Hogan's manager made even less sense than him being DiBiase's manager. And I like Jimmy Hart, but it just was a weird fit.
Yeah, definitely.
Yep. He attacked Backlund right away. I like that they mention DiBiase one time having a long run in the Rumble, and then also Gorilla mentions DiBiase trying to buy the number, I think, for the '89 Rumble. And then he responded to that. That was propaganda. That they,
Yeah, good stuff.
and IRS are tag champs at this point, so I think they had just won the titles. Maybe from Road Warriors, actually, if I recall correctly. But and then DiBiase and Flair, or no, it would have been no, it wouldn't have been from them. Maybe from Natural Disasters. I forget.
I think so. I think so.
So DiBiase and Flair double team Backlund on the ropes, and then Heenan makes a joke asking if you can be arrested for attacking your elders, and then also makes. Now I find this funny because Flair is roughly 8 months older than Backlund, and then DiBiase is 4.5 years younger than Backlund. So, you know, getting into the same age range is just, of course, funny because Backlund is old and Flair and DiBiase are not old, even though they are old. So, just
Yeah.
those funny things. They also get into DiBiase almost becoming WWE champ and that kind of thing. So, they're giving more history than I feel like WWE normally did during these times. Like they're kind of emphasizing some past stuff, you know.
Yeah, that's something that struck me about this event. I feel like that happens a few times later where they really go back to different Rumble events and other big time events to really sell the possibility that these guys could win the Rumble.
Right, exactly. So, also, the crowd not so much into this at the moment, and we still see the weird facial expressions that Bob is giving us, which aren't necessarily helping, I suppose. Then Brian Knobbs is in, and DiBiase and Flair go after him. he ends up getting Irish whipped, but then double clotheslining both of them and punching them out. A house of fire, just kind of weird. That's the fun thing about the Rumble. You just would never expect to see Brian Knobbs clearing house on Ted DiBiase and Ric Flair, but here you have it, you know?
Yeah.
Double noggin knocker. The Knobbs is almost able to toss Flair, punches down DiBiase a bunch. Then they sort of pair off in the corners with Knobbs doing the pity city on Ted DiBiase, the good old armpit to the face move, you know.
Dangerous move, yeah.
So Virgil comes in. They mention the history. Of course, he has a DiBiase, but DiBiase immediately pounds him down. I notice Virgil here has black pinstripes instead of the red pinstripes that I'm typically used to.
The good old candy stripes, yeah.
Exactly. Although he had them in the Survivor Series 92 squash against Yokozuna as well. So where Yokozuna squashed him, not the other way around, obviously.
Yes, yes.
Then Virgil gets an inverted atomic drop on Ted. Then he and Knobbs double backdrop DiBiase. Knobbs tries to clothesline DiBiase, but he goes flying out of the ring when DiBiase ducks and pulls the ropes down. Nice elimination there.
Yeah, classic.
And Backlund goes to the second rope. Flair sort of chops and punches him, but doesn't really lead to anything. It seems like Backlund and Flair have some communication issues throughout, because it just seems like they do a kind of a couple of things that seem a little odd.
Yeah, and it feels like they were kind of going at each other for a large portion of this Rumble. But yeah, some kind of sloppy miscommunication here and there.
I mean, nothing that was, like, horrible, but just sort of seemed like they just had some things where nothing was really going on.
Right.
And sort of getting in the way of other people, too. There was a decent amount of that kind of thing, of a guy getting in another guy's way in this Rumble. And that's obviously difficult in the Rumble because you have so many bodies in there. And
yeah,
it's a challenge, but... number seven, we have Jerry Lawler. So pretty much an all-time legends group with Lawler, DiBiase, and Flair. And then we also have Virgil as well.
Yes, yes. And huge reaction for Lawler at this point. He was very, you know, very much a hated villain, I think, at this point.
And he had just come in.
Right.
I believe might be his first in-ring performance in WWF. Because he had just started hosting Superstars like a month before. In fact, later on, Heenan and Gorilla get into the argument of who is the host of Superstars, with Gorilla believing that it was Vince, which, you know, obviously is ridiculous.
Yeah, I thought that was hilarious, especially when Heenan suggests that Vince actually gets Lawler's coffee for him, which is just great.
Yeah. So... Lawler helps DiBiase out with Virgil, and then suddenly Flair grabs Lawler and takes him into another corner, out of nowhere, and almost like Flair, Lawler has to play the babyface for like a minute while for that sequence where Jerry punches him down and then Flair bails underneath the ropes. Also noticing that Lawler's pretty skinny here, During this time, I kind of remember him generally having a bit of a belly, but he got a little, at least in a bit of better shape for his WWF run.
Yeah, it seems so. Yeah.
Yeah. Then Flair tries to dump Virgil, but Lawler stops it. And then we have number eight, Max Moon.
Ah, yes.
Sort of ends the Parade of Legends for the moment. He gets a dropkick on Lawler right away. But then it's cut off by Flair, whips him into the ropes and gets a Max Moon whips him into the ropes and gets a backdrop. Flair tosses Max Moon over, but Max Moon skins the cat. Later, Moon does a reverse spin kick on Lawler, but then he tries for the second time, ends up being backdropped over the ropes. So I wish to point out for anyone listening to this who might be a future entrant in the Royal Rumble, it is not a good idea to run at your opponent if he is up against the ropes.
Yeah, probably not the best idea.
This is not, yeah. Wikipedia tells me that Max Moon here is Paul Diamond, the half of the Orient Express, but most famously half of Bad Company. Same tag partners, different gimmick, but
yeah.
With Pat Tanaka, so
right, and the Max Moon character was originally, was that Conan? I think I've heard that.
It was original. My understanding is it was really meant for Conan, and then and I think he even like designed it, and then he had a falling out with he didn't last long in WWE, and they gave it. I think Brady Boone might have taken it over either after this. It didn't last. It lasted maybe a month or two, and or maybe a little bit more. But either way, it was not in any way important and did not make any sort of major appearance on pay-per-view after this. So,
Right. Yeah.
speaking of legends, we have number nine. We have Tenryu,
Tenryu, yes.
who has a fun chop exchange with Flair, which Tenryu wins handily. Flair flops again and then begs off. We also see Virgil punching Lawler on the ropes and biting him. And then Flair ends up slingshotting Virgil back into the ring, which was visually impressive, although I question his tactic because you're trying to get the guy out of the ring.
Yeah, very curious move, yeah.
Gorilla wishes he had a running clock for how long Flair and Backlund had been out there, which is sort of funny because you can kind of guess it based on the number that the guy who just came in. But you know, and eventually he's clued into how long Flair and Backlund are out there, which it would be close to like 15, 16, 18 minutes at this point. So, because
Right, yeah, just about.
number 10 is Mr. Perfect, who gets a big pop.
Huge pop, yeah.
He had become a good guy in sort of an interesting way. I mentioned the tag match earlier, the Survivor Series with Perfect and Savage, and Perfect became Savage's partner only because Warrior had, as we mentioned, left or been fired or whatever from WWE. And so they did a really fun one night thing on Primetime Wrestling where Savage wanted Perfect to be his partner, even though Perfect had been Flair's manager and hadn't wrestled for about a year and a half. And so Heenan thinks this is ridiculous and kind of berates the idea. And then they kind of go throughout the show where Perfect thinks kind of keeps like thinking about it. It's like, well, maybe kind of thing, you know. And eventually Heenan pushes his buttons too far and Perfect agrees to do it. And then, you know, is really, really super over as a good guy for a while. Didn't really, his run sort of ended in the summer of 93 and he went back into retirement, but well, 3.5 year retirement until he came back to WCW. But yeah, he was super over, no question about it.
Yeah, I was actually surprised. I feel like, you know, my memory of Mr. Perfect as a hero, you know, I didn't really think of him as being so over, but he definitely was, especially at this point.
Yeah, well, he had the you know, I he had the big win against Flair the next night, and of course he and Bret Hart had their big rematch at the King of the Ring 93, which Perfect was hugely overrun. And then he had the feud with Shawn Michaels, which was a pretty good feud, although the match itself at SummerSlam always was pretty disappointing to me.
Yeah.
But I mean, he was involved in some big things. Had a feud with Luger at WrestleMania that didn't really, you know, that didn't really go anywhere too much. But that kind of sort of continued Perfect's issue with Bobby Heenan, who was had of course been associated with Flair and then was about to be associated with the narcissist Lex Luger, who made his debut. In fact, kind of the other thing that this Rumble is known for about. With Lex Luger coming out, introducing himself as the narcissist, and having a bunch of mirrors and so forth, and having that debut.
Right, yeah.
So anyway, the Perfect falls victim to the thumb to the eye, but he strikes back pretty quickly, gets chops in the corner and a big punch and a big knee lift. Flair cuts him off very briefly with another thumb to the eye, but Flair heads to the top. And as you know, Flair going to the top generally does not work out, slammed off right away. Then Perfect gets the next, and Flair sort of kicks low to slow him down. Heenan going crazy at this point, wanting Flair to eliminate Perfect and not being happy with how things are going for the most part. And right as Perfect is doing the 10 punches on Flair, we have a number 11 entrant is Skinner, who was Alligator Man type gimmick, was always sort of dirty and sleazy and kind of gross. And interesting was played by Steve Kern, who previously had been best known for being one of the heartthrob Fabulous Ones, a tag team in the 80s. So just kind of funny how that character.
Yeah, I love seeing that happen, even though this character didn't really go over too well. But I love seeing such a drastic shift in a wrestler's gimmick. Always fun to see.
He didn't last much longer. He wasn't at WrestleMania. I'm pretty sure he was gone, not too long after this. So, and Gorilla, of all things, mentions what a big smile he has coming out. And we also have Flair whipping Perfect, but it being reversed, and then Perfect clotheslines Flair over the top rope to a big pop. And then you see Flair having a heavy amount of frustration. And then Lawler and Perfect battling for old time's sake, harkening back to their 1988 AWA feud. Virgil sort of grabs Lawler's arms as if he wants Perfect to attack him, but Perfect sort of blows that off and goes off into another direction. So, and then number 12, Coco Beware and his huge pants.
Massive, yes. Huge genie pants.
Huge pants, yeah. They're held up by suspenders, but they're very... They're very baggy otherwise. He is half of High Energy at this point, although their run was just about to end. And his tag team partner was Owen Hart. So Owen Hart had come in as Jim Neidhart's tag partner with a new foundation, and they had sort of those same kind of wacky outfits. Then Jim Neidhart was phased out, and they had Coco be his tag partner, who was more of a natural tag partner as far as similar styles go. They, I don't really recall anything that they particularly did, but they were around for a year, so I'm sure they, had something fun at least.
Yeah, I remember seeing them wrestle as a tag team on episodes of Superstars and such, and it was always just, a lot of fun, kind of fitting their name, but nothing huge ever happened.
Right. Yeah. Like, I don't know if they had any title matches or anything, or anything noteworthy other than, just kind of being high flying guys who would win the squash or would lose against the name teams kind of thing. So,
yeah, exactly.
Now Heenan here, after Coco goes after Lawler, Heenan here is trying very hard to convince me that Coco could win this Rumble, but I'm just not seeing it, to be honest,
Yeah. I'm not really sold on that idea either.
One thing I've noticed about Coco is after he goes after Virgil here, Coco was not afraid to go after the good guys during the Rumble. Like, he would do that fairly often. I remember in the it's either the 89 or the 90 Rumble, he goes after Hogan. Coco would definitely play into the whole every man for himself type thing at the Rumbles, and other guys didn't do that nearly as much.
Yeah, and I like seeing that, but I do remember as a child, I might have been around 9 years old when I first saw this Rumble. I remember being outraged at seeing that kind of behavior. I expected better from all of my heroes, but it's kind of fun to see now.
Yeah. So Perfect tosses Skinner over, who skins the cat, but then Perfect dropkicks him over to send him out for the thing. Heenan very angry at Mr. Perfect's success, and then this sort of leads into a where he is angry at Gorilla and almost challenges to him to a fight, but then backs off and says that he can't do it because of his bad back. So
good stuff. Yeah.
Right. So Coco jumps off the second rope and lands a headbutt on DiBiase, and number 13 is Samu, who's not called by his name, but in fact is called one half of the Head Shrinkers by Gorilla Monsoon. And this is the first time that I realized that Gorilla tends to forget your name a lot if you are in a tag team.
Yeah, that was definitely a habit for him. It's kind of funny to see.
Now, granted, from far away, Samu and Fatu look a decent amount alike. So I can understand. I don't think Gorilla's eyesight was his strongest suit anyway. Given the things that he might miss on occasion on commentary. So, we'll give him that. It's just interesting in more of the tag teams where the guys are pretty distinguishable between each other that he would do that. But fun for always fun to get to see the gorilla-isms.
Yeah, and speaking of which, he refers to Afa as Samu's manager, trainer, and feeder, which is kind of a funny little moment.
Afa also grabs, he basically grabs Samu by the hair through, they run or jog to in the entranceway, and then he basically throws him in through the hair. It's like he's throwing a guy into the ring. It was sort of an odd thing, although I guess it kind of fits the gimmick portraying. Lawler comes off the second rope and punches Perfect. We're obviously getting pretty crowded here since we haven't had an elimination in a while. Backlund holds Lawler, and Perfect chops him hard. Then Backlund and Perfect do it for a bit, and Lawler knocks their heads together. Just kind of a funny little three-way exchange that they have there.
Yeah.
Number 14 is the Berserker.
All right.
Yeah, who is all right. Around really? For a couple years, but didn't really do all that much. It's weird because he's the type of guy who it feels like they would push heavily because he's really tall and big and has kind of that you know, big bushy beard and, you know, kind of scary looking, but he had that kind of silly Viking / Bruiser Brody knockoff gimmick that I don't really think did him any favors. I don't recall Berserker. Like, I feel like he had a feud with Davey Boy Smith, but I don't really remember him ever doing anything big or mattering that much in WWE, even though he was around for a couple years.
Right. Yeah. He definitely does seem like the kind of guy who could be, you know, body type could have been big, but yeah, his weird gimmick and those funny noises he made didn't help matters much.
I mean, I've always thought he was okay. He had some runs in the AWA. He was in WCW in the late 90s for like a few months, like 97, 98, if I recall. I think he might have been part of Jimmy Hart's, he might have like been in the Faces of Fear or the bigger stable, not the tag team, for a bit. But, you know, either way, John Nord is what he went by there. I just always kind of thought bigger things should have happened for him. For whatever reason, they did not. But meanwhile, we have Lawler trying to slug Mr. Perfect, but Lawler's backdropped over. Then DiBiase sends Perfect to the apron. He keeps trying to knee him out. And Coco Beware ends up going in, and they tease several eliminations on Perfect, but then Lawler from behind ends up pulling him out. And they, although it takes a little bit because they're sort of all tangling with referees, Danny Davis and Bill Alfonso, trying to keep Lawler from pulling Perfect out. But then eventually Perfect falls down, and Lawler and Perfect sort of brawl with each other on the outside. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I found that super interesting because I don't recall anything happening after this. You know, they'd have a nice little brawl on the outside. Lawler's clearly at least partially responsible for Mr. Perfect being eliminated. Seems like this could build to something between those two, and nothing really happened.
Yeah, they more went with instead they kind of went with Luger and Perfect, and I don't really recall Lawler having any kind of in-ring feud until, you know, Bret Hart in the summer of 93. So,
right.
Yeah. Although apparently Jarrett and Lawler had was happening to go to historyofwwe.com, and Lawler and Mr. Perfect had a match in Memphis in a USWA match. So.
Oh.
I guess maybe that was like to set that up for the local fans and, you know, not really any sort of issue either way, because WWF and USWA kind of had a talent exchange thing at this point. USWA kind of like acting almost as like a bit of a minor league for them. Yeah.
Right, right.
It looks like Lawler, you know, basically for as far as in-ring stuff, just kind of randomly, like he and Jerry Lawler feuded for a while. And I believe this was during the time in which the McMahon in Memphis thing. So, or that might've been a little bit later, but that might've been leading to that. I think that was actually later in 93, but, Lawler, you know, didn't really do much TV matches or, you know, a whole lot of things. It was just basically doing the working as mostly as a commentator until, you know, the feud with Brett in mid 93.
Right. Yeah. After the King of the Ring victory.
Right. So Undertaker is comes in with Paul Bearer, and it's nice because it's right when Lawler is standing in the middle of the entranceway, and he sort of has to take step aside, and then he kind of gives like Undertaker and Paul Bearer a look like what am I doing, you know, like, oh, you know, these guys are spookier, you know, just kind of like gotten myself into in, you know, wrestling and WWF kind of look.
Yeah, it was a really nice moment. He was clearly impressed.
Yeah, so there's a big pop for Undertaker there. They make their way slowly, and Heenan has the fun line of, by the time he gets to the ring, it'll be time for WrestleMania.
Yeah.
Sammu attacks him right away. Then we see Berserker sending Backlund through the ropes and then randomly attacking him with a chair on the outside for quite a while. Now, it doesn't really seem like there's any good reason for this, although we see how it functions in the Rumble as things occur in just a moment. Taker dumps Sammu and then gets chopped and hit with an enziguri by Tenryu. Tenryu then charges, but Taker backdrops him out. Again, not a good touch to charge at somebody in the Rumble. Then lands an uppercut on Coco and DiBiase. We have Backlund on the outside, having been beaten up by Berserker. Berserker comes back in and misses a charge on Coco Beware. It's for whatever reason, it struck me as very funny to see Berserker and Coco Beware in the ring at the same time.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot of fun to see those guys, yeah.
So we have Terry Taylor in, who I was sort of randomly just, was in and out, I think, in late 92 through 93, in it, having his own name, the Red Rooster name not being mentioned at all, kind of thing, but was just sort of like your random, you know, veteran who was just around for whatever reason. He goes after Coco. Gorilla refers to him as full of all kinds of energy, which I didn't really see. He was just Terry Taylor, but whatever. Coco almost tosses him, but then DiBiase ends up dumping them both. Taker then chokeslams DiBiase and clotheslines him over. Taker and Berserker fight in the corner. Berserker lands a bunch of headbutts to Undertaker's stomach.
Yeah.
And then we suddenly see a giant man in a furry caveman suit, with for those who have seen it, it's pretty inexplicable. But yeah, it's a bodysuit that sort of shows like fake muscles, and I don't recall it having the fur so much later. I think the fur was more a thing they just did here, and they took the fur away when he was around. But he lumbers to the ring. Harvey Whippleman is with him. Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby wonder who it is. Taker ends up backdropping Berserker and then notices out of the ring, and then notices the giant. And the giant lifts his arms up, takes one awkward step. Taker takes a step toward him. The buzzer goes off, but the camera doesn't cut to the entrance. It's Damian Demento.
Right, who doesn't even enter the ring at this point.
So each of them take another step. They are close to each other. They do a stare down, and Taker's clearly much, much shorter. They both take a swing at each other, and the giant, who strikes, who is still not named, in fact, is not named at all during this encounter, but is Giant Gonzalez, better or also known as El Gigante in WCW. He strikes Taker atop the head, chops him out of the ring. Then he chops and headbutts him down, throws him into the steps, and then Gorilla and Bobby are sort of making mention that Harvey Whippleman has been seeking revenge on Undertaker for beating Kamala and putting him in the casket in a casket match. So obviously this is Harvey Whippleman's new find. But they head back in the ring. Gonzalez chokeslams him. Then he slowly steps over the ropes. And number 18 is IRS, who also does not really get too involved right away. Gonzalez then pulls Taker's legs toward the ring post. He's outside the ring, slams his leg repeatedly on the post. He keeps attacking the refs. A bunch of refs and officials, including Sergeant Slaughter and Tony Garea, come out and try to convince him to leave. And then basically eventually they do convince him to leave. And I don't know, I actually kind of thought this was a pretty effective debut, except, of course, for the ridiculous suit. Well, what were your thoughts?
Right. The suit was definitely insane. I think it's hard to see it and not laugh at it. But otherwise, it was definitely an effective debut. I think there was a lot made of how this is Undertaker's first real beatdown. Like, I don't think fans were used to seeing him hurt this badly. You know, at the hands of one other guy.
The fans seemed into this. They seemed invested in it. They seemed shocked and so forth. I mean, Gonzalez was obviously slow and lumbering, but, you know, he did okay. He didn't do anything that seemed like, you know, terrible or anything.
Right, especially here. Like, he came in, he, you know, he kind of towers over the Undertaker, and, you know, a very effective beatdown, you could say. Like, it's really, like, I remember being interested in what would happen next.
And, I mean, I don't think Gonzalez just didn't really have the presence or the ability to, you know, have any kind of staying power. But, you know, at least this was a decent first step. And, again, the suit was just that really, I do think, made him just seem like, you know, comical rather than menacing. But
definitely. And actually, by the way, that fur, I remember actually it became incorporated into the kind of, you know, that airbrush thing there. They took off the real fur and kind of drew it onto that suit.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. The airbrushed muscles, I think, were the silliest part of the thing. I don't know if you're an Arrested Development fan, but it reminds me of the episode of Arrested Development where George Michael tries to put the muscle suit on to impress Maybe because, you know, he thinks that she's tricked into believing he has real muscles. So.
Right. Yeah. And that was just excellent.
I believe is the phrase there. So anyway, IRS and Damien Demento double team on Bob Backlund, who's back in the ring after about 5 minutes selling the chair shot beating. Meanwhile, Undertaker is still prone to the corner. He tries to sit up, do the zombie sit up, but he can't do it. Demento eventually betrays IRS, rakes him in the eyes. Backlund headbutts IRS, and the heels double team again. So their differences don't last very long. The devil and the IRS. Is Damien Demento, I guess, it's meant to be like a devil enthusiast as opposed to the devil himself?
Yeah, he's supposed to be some sort of, almost Satanist, one would suggest, but definitely just crazy. I think that's what he communicated when he was out there.
Implied Satanism, not out and out said, but
right.
Damien, you know, is obviously a clue there. But he had a sort of a weird, like, he was bald except for like a black ponytail. He kind of had like a black outfit with sort of some kind of trim coming from it. He wasn't really a memorable guy. He didn't last very long either. Other than just kind of being silly and ridiculous, he didn't stand out as someone who was worth all that money.
Right.
He didn't. I tried to find some him and didn't really stand there, and it seemed like they really extend the character all that well. I guess he's sort of known for some ranting on YouTube.
Yeah, there was that, and I think he's kind of become, I think, what would you say, like a trivia note, because I think he was one of the first competitors in the first match of Raw ever.
Yeah, I believe that's right.
Right.
So good for him. He gets that at least.
Yeah.
And number 19 is Tatanka, who is in the midst of he's defeated at this point still. And he's been around for a good part of 92 at least. Meanwhile, the Undertaker is still out in the corner. Paul Bearer tries to revive him with the urn, is screaming about the power of the urn. Undertaker sits up a little bit and stumbles out. At this point, I noticed he has yellow stuck to his glove, which just sort of distracts me. It almost looks like it's like a pin that's stuck to his glove, or
yeah,
I can't really tell what it is. It's very well. Anyway, so we're back to the action, and Demento very weakly punches Backlund while IRS holds him, and then accidentally nails IRS. Tatanka body slams IRS, and then we have Jerry Sags in, or if you're Gorilla Monsoon, the other half of the Nasty Boys.
Yeah.
And IRS hits an inverted atomic drop onto Tatanka, who Gorilla mentions specifically is an undefeated Native American.
Yeah, at this point, that was pretty much his full name. He was the undefeated Native American Tatanka.
Exactly. Yes. So Sags pulls IRS by the tie, and they brawl for a little bit. And Backlund at this point has been in for 36 minutes. Tatanka chops Demento, and then Backlund goes after IRS with some punches and lifts him up onto the ropes. Then number 21 is Typhoon, who was nearing the end of his run as well. He and Earthquake were tag partners as the Natural Disasters, had been in the championship picture for a couple of years and had a reign or two as champions. But he, and in fact, not 93, he would be best known for his disastrous turn as the Shockmaster in WCW, that infamous debut. But here he splashes Demento repeatedly in the corner, steps on his throat. Tatanka chops Sags in the other corner. Typhoon lifts Demento up by the throat, but then IRS hits him from behind and goes after the eyes.
And right.
Number 22 is Fatu, who Gorilla says is the other half of the Head Shrinkers, and then actually says Fatu. So it's close.
Yeah.
He actually does refer to his name, even though it's a little bit off in the pronunciation.
Yeah, I actually noticed that pronunciation too. Classic stuff from Gorilla there.
Yeah, and then Afa slaps him around a little bit and then sends him in. Not quite the same introduction that he gave to Samu, but similar enough. And we get a super kick on Typhoon. He headbutts Demento and IRS. Doesn't really get much of a reaction out of this. And IRS and Demento double team Typhoon, but then Backlund rams their heads together. Then 23 is Earthquake, who is Typhoon's partner, but for whatever reason attacks him again. Gets an Irish whip, but Typhoon clotheslines him down. Typhoon splashes him in the corner, and then this allows Gorilla to get the irresistible force meets the movable object line, which he likes to do with bigger, strong guys. Typhoon whips him into the other corner and then gets an avalanche. A second avalanche misses, though, and then Typhoon ends up being sent out by Earthquake. Typhoon points at him, just sort of angry that he was randomly attacked by his tag partner, and Bobby wonders if they will ever be able to patch things up. So, my understanding is that this kind of, I think Typhoon left before this really was going to be leading to anything, but it was sort of interesting that they just, went that direction. I guess obviously it adds to the whole issue of, you know, these guys, everyone in it for themselves. But
yeah, I think that ended up being the, the takeaway from that. But my understanding is that this was supposed to lead to a one-on-one feud with them, but Typhoon decided to leave the company shortly after this event.
Gotcha. Yeah. So number 24, Carlos Colon. He is the father of Carlito, of course, and Primo, and the uncle of Epico. And he is referred to as the Caribbean champion, and Gorilla Monsoon says that there's a lot of fire in this youngster.
Yeah.
He is a year older than Bob Backlund in real life. So
yeah, that's a kind of hilarious moment there.
Right. So Damien is thrown to the apron and Colon and Tatanka try to kick him down. It does not work. Colon then punches Demento a bunch and then backdrops him over after a Demento flurry. Earthquake squashes Backlund's ribs in the corner, then lifts him up onto the ropes. We're at 46 minutes for Backlund at this point. Then number 25, Tito Santana, who gets a decent pop, is still in his El Matador gear. He had gotten that character, I believe, toward the end of 91 and 92 or so. So he goes after Backlund for a bit, and then Earthquake. Fatu is sent over the ropes hard by Backlund. Bob and IRS team up together to try to toss Tito. Then Tito comes close to getting Backlund over, and fans are now, they're a bit into Backlund getting the longevity record. I mean, they're not super into him. They're certainly not as into him as Gorilla and Bobby are trying to make it seem that they are into him. But they, whenever there's a tease of him getting eliminated out, the crowd certainly is responding.
Right, exactly. And I feel like, yeah, this is around the time where you see the crowd. They're definitely more invested in what's happening with Backlund at this point, especially when they're teasing an elimination.
Yeah, and we get a close-up of Backlund sweaty and exhausted and a crowd chant that I can't exactly make out going on. So I don't know if you caught it or if you had any idea what they were saying, but
no.
Number 26 is Rick Martel, who goes after Tito 4 years after the Strikeforce breakup. Usually it's Tito who is accused of not being able to get over that breakup, but Rick seems to have the issues here, so for whatever reason.
Yeah, I feel like this is something that happened pretty often in these early 90s Rumbles, where former tag partners, no matter how long it'd been since they split, kind of go after each other, and it's always really fun to see.
Yeah, yeah. So Tito rams his head into the buckle 10 times, then he rakes Tito's eyes. IRS is sent out of the ring by Earthquake. Then Sags and Earthquake shove each other for a little bit. Tito gets Backlund out again, but Bob falls onto the apron. Gorilla refers to it as one hell of a reaction, which I wouldn't quite go that far, but he gets cheers for doing that. Tito comes off the second rope, and Backlund punches him in the gut. Then Earthquake lifts up Carlos Colon, tries to dump him, but then Colon stays on the apron. Number 27, Yokozuna with Mr. Fuji, and both Gorilla and Bobby give an uh-oh, as in, like, it's on now type thing.
Right.
Yokozuna has the uncommon, the white tights on. Usually he would have the red ones with the black, I'm not sure what you call that, but the sumo thing that goes basically around his crotch and it serves as a belt.
Yeah, I noticed that. I'm used to seeing him with the red. I don't know how often we saw him with this color scheme.
Recall it. I've seen him with a black one as well, but I don't really recall him having the white one as much. But or he would have the red pants with the white belt. But anyway, it's unusual. He headbutts Tatanka. They have a chop exchange, and Yoko ends up tossing Tatanka out pretty easily. Carlos tries. They trade some headbutts, but then Colon gets dumped out. He hangs. Well, he's able to hang on for a brief moment, but then Yoko punches him off the apron. It's a fun stare down with Earthquake. Earthquake points at him. Yoko gets to a sumo stance. Earthquake does his little Earthquake hop that he would do when he would set up his big finisher. Gorilla calls the reaction deafening, which I'm not quite there with him, but it's you know, people are into it.
There's definitely a crowd reaction. It's a super fun spot, yeah.
Earthquake charges, and Yoko does not move at all. They repeat the same thing. Number 28 is Owen Hart, but we don't cut to his entrance. We do see him as he runs in right at the very end. Earthquake gets a clothesline, but Yoko doesn't go down. Earthquake hits a first avalanche, but doesn't hit the second one. Then there's a they end up getting a belly-to-belly, and Earthquake is sent over after that. So a big suplex gets him out. Pretty impressive.
Really impressive there, yeah. He just kind of chucked him over.
Right, exactly. Owen has the sleep baggy outfit that that Coco had as well. He goes after Martel. Gorilla seems to indicate that he likes Owen's chances, although he concedes that he would need help with the Yokozuna, but there's enough guys that they could group up and team to get him out. Tito tries to go after Yoko and get clotheslined out. Interesting that Gorilla liked Owen and Heenan liked Coco. I guess they both were fans of High Energy.
I guess so, yeah.
Yoko tosses Tito out, but he lands on the apron. And then 29 is the Repo Man, who... you know, the Repo wasn't necessarily my favorite character ever, but I do really enjoy his skipping out and doing a bit of a hop here as he comes out. Just sort of a silly little entrance that he did.
Yeah, he was really good at just kind of like always being on when he was out there, like totally being in the Repo Man character.
Yeah, yeah. He tries to punch Yoko, but is headbutted down. Yoko goes after Tito. Martel has Owen on the ropes. Tito and Backlund try to team up to eliminate Yokozuna, and all the others try to help out, but Yoko sort of individually fends them off. And then Yoko and Backlund battle a bit on the corner. Sags tries to get on Yoko's shoulder, but that doesn't work out.
I thought it was super interesting here. I don't know how often I've seen like the big guy fight out of a gang elimination. It might happen more often than I'm remembering, but you know, I feel like usually you get that many guys on one person and you know, it will be an elimination. So it was really cool that he was able to fight them off like that.
Seven or eight guys. Yeah, I mean, I've seen Andre fight off three or four, but usually that number, you're right. It's usually they're able to get him off. And it was a good spot to, yeah, because the crowd was invested in that idea. And I'm sure that they, you know, kind of realized that he was a favorite at this point. And most of them probably didn't want him to win since he's the bad guy and all. But so number 30, Randy Savage, huge pop as you'd expect.
Yep.
He's definitely getting phased down at this point, which I don't know. I feel like there's a point of view that thinks that he was kind of misused in that role. And obviously, you know, he had great success as a main event guy in WCW a few years later. But at the same time, you know, as far as moving away into the new generation, I don't know how much you want Savage there sort of still being a dominant guy.
Right. I think for many fans, it seemed maybe a bit sudden. You know, it wasn't terribly long ago that he was the top guy, the champion in the company. So I think, you know, in my memory anyway, it seemed a bit sudden. But, yeah, you know, there's a conversation to be had there.
Sure. He's for the cowboy hat era for Savage, it's not too bad of an ensemble. It's lime green and sort of black and purple with frills. I mean, it's gaudy, but by that the standards of gaudiness that Savage would have there, it's relatively muted.
Right.
He chokes Repo Man without with his boot for a bit. Tito comes off the ropes, but Yoko cuts him down and then tosses him out. Owen comes off the ropes. He tries to dropkick Martel, but sends Sags out inside. Then Martel tosses Owen, who skins the cat, although is sort of fails to skin the cat the first time, but gets up the second time.
That always gets me nervous when they fail the first time, but yeah.
He tries to get Yoko from behind, but then fails. Owen runs toward Yoko, again, not a good idea, gets hip-tossed out. Then Owen sort of, it lands pretty awkwardly and holds his knee on the landing. So I don't know if he was legit hurt there or what, but it looked pretty nasty.
Yeah, it was a really nasty spill. Yeah.
And then next he, next we have, let's see, where I lost my place just a moment. And Savage tosses Repo Man out too. So now we're down to the final four: Yokozuna, Randy Savage, Rick Martel, and Bob Backlund. Of course, Savage, Martel being, you know, mainstays of the you know, past era of WWE, of the past 5 or 6 years or more. Backlund being the old man, you know, the kind of the story of his comeback, and then Yokozuna being the fresh new guy. Martel sends Savage into the corner and then goes after Bob. He tries a fireman's carry, but Backlund won't let it happen. Yokozuna stands on Savage's throat. Martel finally gets Bob up, drapes him on the ropes, so Backlund's on. So we're 61 minutes into the match, and the record for Flair is 62 minutes, so just about to beat that. Each of them tries a suplex. Backlund gets Martel on the ropes and punches him off the top to a decent pop. And then Gorilla calls, "Listen to that ovation." Backlund. So Bob tries to attack Yoko from behind. He drop kicks him, sending him back a bit. Another one puts Yoko on the ropes, but then he makes the mistake of charging, and Yoko tosses him over. So we get some medium level of boos for that, and then Gorilla and Bobby refer to it as a standing ovation for Bob Backlund. When no one's standing, I see no one really ovating.
So, yeah.
Not really quite matching the story with the reality that they have, but oh well. Which, you know, kind of brings up an interesting point. Like, obviously, this wasn't really that effective for Backlund. Backlund didn't really do a whole lot interesting in WWE for another year and a half or more until he and Bret Hart wrestled in a match in which, you know, he almost beats Bret to win the title and then turns heel right afterward after he fails to win. But, like, do you think that, like, I kind of think like Tito Santana might have been a more effective guy in this role of kind of the scrappy underdog getting like one last chance to, you know, to come back and to be at the top level again.
Yeah, I feel like Tito Santana would have been a good candidate for that role. I think Bob Backlund was an odd choice if that's what they were going for at this time. I think, again, you did see, you know, some decent crowd reaction develop. You know, he spent over an hour in there. But yeah, it was just kind of a weird situation. Another point about Backlund, though, I thought it was super interesting when he came back to face Bret in 94 and how they painted him as like the ultimate kind of like curmudgeon, you know, this like basically turning old folks into villains at that point. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, you know, and they were playing off of course, the a you know, the well, later when he was going after the title, they played off like the George Foreman having won the boxing title at the same time. So they were definitely kind of taking advantage of that. But you're right, it was really the way Backlund evolved was interesting. But it just was it was just sort of random to have him be here and really not get that much of a. And it certainly got a better one toward the end. I mean, it wasn't like it was a disaster. It was just like far less of one than they either seemed to be expecting or were trying to get us to expect. And I just wonder, if they had other options that would have been good, or like a young guy like Tatanka, having him, be in that role, trying to build him up kind of. He seemed like a guy they were trying to build into a future star. It just sort of seemed like a bit of an odd choice to have Backlund be the guy to break that record. And I guess probably they wanted someone to break the record since Flair was leaving. They didn't want to be the guy to have that longevity mark.
Yeah. We kind of touched on, I guess, like growing pains and how this is a transitional period. This is kind of where the new generation is developing, but I think, the company's still kind of, I don't want to say stuck in their old ways, but kind of trying to rely on wrestlers that, have put in that kind of work in the past, wrestlers who they're very familiar with. So kind of straddling this kind of old and new generation created kind of a weird situation for this event in particular.
Yeah, well, it was kind of like the old Hogan era stuff that had worked for a long time when Hogan was there, kind of stopped working, and they were trying to forge a new path, and it was just sort of like which way to approach it. And they tried a lot of experiments. They tried to experiment with a lot of things over the next 3 or 4 to 5 years before they kind of hit on Austin, McMahon, and the Attitude Era stuff. Which obviously was what clicked.
Exactly.
And obviously a lot of that was, given to them on the ECW template. And also, a lot of the growth came from WCW taking it to them in the Monday Night Wars and the NWO. So it was more external pressures that brought what they had, as opposed to, finding what works internally, which, of course, is always interesting.
Yeah, I think this is definitely, an argument could be made that external threats really helped the company grow, because at this point, we weren't seeing as much of that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So WCW was certainly around doing what they were doing, but it wasn't like they were taking it to WWF, and they didn't have the same face-to-face competition that they would later have. So they both were kind of targeting different audiences, targeting different regions for the most part too. So,
right.
Anyway, Yokozuna punches Savage down to the two of them. Then he elbows to the back of the neck. Fuji is at ringside. Savage keeps dragging himself to the ropes. And basically we have a number for the next few minutes. We're just going to have Yokozuna beating up Savage a bunch. And then Savage trying to, get in a little bit of offense here. And there are some kicks and punches, but leaning on the ropes and selling just the pretty bad beating that he's getting. Then Savage is able to get to the top, get an axe handle to stagger Yokozuna a bit. Then another one to the back that Yoko goes down on one knee, but then immediately he's cut off with a super kick. Yoko gets a belly to belly. Fuji shouts instructions to him, and Yoko gets a leg drop. He keeps punching him, and Savage keeps going down and then slowly and dramatically making his way to the ropes and pulling himself up. Yoko hits a backsplash into the corner, but the second time it misses. Savage goes to the top, and really good timing where Yokozuna falls down off of that right close to the ropes. Savage hits the elbow, and there's a lot of controversy over this finish, but I'm actually sort of like it, and I'll explain why after we describe it. Savage hits the elbow. He goes for a cover. Yokozuna presses him over the top rope and to the floor. And a lot of people don't like that finish, just because, of course, Savage is going for a cover and it's a Royal Rumble match where you can't win by pin. But I can buy Savage being groggy and momentarily forgetting that pins don't count in the match and because of how badly he's been beaten up. And it's pretty a physically impressive way to get Savage out of the ring, and it's kind of cool. So I actually like it. What do you think?
I agree. I think for a long time I wasn't a fan of the finish because, again, pinfalls clearly don't count. But I think, you know, this is there was a lot of adrenaline here. You know, Savage is building up a lot of offense. Yokozuna, I think this is the first time he's ever been downed in a WWF ring. So I can buy it. You know, I can buy that Savage was kind of lost in the moment, really excited, and, you know, had a lapse there.
Right, exactly. So we have some epic Roman gladiator music playing. Caesar and Cleopatra come out, and they lead Yoko sort of to the entranceway with the other gladiators. And we get a close-up of Yoko making a mean face. And that basically ends the show. Yoko is the first heel to win the Royal Rumble. This is the first year in which it gets an automatic title shot. So Yokozuna is going to face Bret Hart, as they mentioned a bunch. Or first they say, well, he'll meet Bret Hart. And then they're like, well, he'll meet Bret Hart if Bret Hart's the champion. But you never know. He might lose it.
Right, right. Anything can happen.
Anything can happen in the World Wrestling Federation. Absolutely.
Indeed, indeed.
So my version of it, they had a clip of a sort of a photo shoot afterward with Yoko is shown, as the winner. And then Bret sort of gets into his face holding the title. And then they kind of cut right on that. They don't even show any talking. It's more just like a silent clip, just very brief, of showing that happening. So and of setting up the match, of course. So, you know, I mean, this is a pretty effective way of making Yokozuna into, you know, a big villain as much as they could. I think there were some limitations on that character, but it certainly, he was probably the best choice they had at the time. Unless they were going to turn Undertaker or something like that, or just try one more time with Savage or something along those lines. But as far as, you know, doing a new fresh face, you know, Yokozuna was about as good of an option as they had.
Yeah, I noticed on my version too. I see, you know, there's a clip of Bret Hart getting in Yokozuna's face. It's, you know, kind of funny there. I thought that was interesting too, because I feel like at the end of the Rumble, Savage and Yokozuna had what I felt was a really great exchange there. You know, it made me wonder whether a Savage Yokozuna feud could have been successful. You know, I don't think we ever really saw one-on-one competition with those two, but that's kind of just like wiped immediately with Bret showing up in the back there.
Yeah. We did have, they did a Raw match actually. Savage and Yokozuna did before WrestleMania. That was like one of Yokozuna's last major matches before WrestleMania. So
is that the one where Crush turned? Am I thinking of the right one?
You know what? You might be right. That may have been that match may have happened in '94 before WrestleMania 10 with Yokozuna being champion.
Right, right, right.
And then Crush gets involved in it and costs Savage the match. And that feud began when Yokozuna crushed a bunch of times, and then and Savage didn't help him out until after the third time. So, and then Crush was mad about that. So, right, yeah, right. Now that I think about it, I think you're right. I don't think they had anything leading into that so forth. Yeah, that would have been an interesting dynamic just because, stylistically, that would work very well.
Yeah, I noticed in this finishing sequence, we got very much kind of a David and Goliath thing, which, you know, I don't know how often that happened in Savage's WWF career anyway. I thought that could have been cool.
Yeah, well, he had matches against Andre. He had a one-man gang. You know, he fought some of the big heels during his time as champion and during his time as a good guy in WWE. But I mean, Savage was great pretty much everything he did. But yeah, Savage was good in those circumstances, working off the big guy, you know, taking the big bumps and so on and so forth.
Definitely.
All right, Luke, well, is there anything else you want to get into here? Of course, you have a number of plugs I know that you want to make.
Nothing left about the event. Again, I think this is a super interesting time, something kind of interesting to study, the early 90s wrestling. As far as what I'm up to, you can find me on Twitter and Tumblr. Both are over as fuck. Those are my usernames. And essentially, I'm just a wrestling fan spilling thoughts out onto the internet, and I think it can be pretty fun and sometimes pretty insightful.
Cool. Well, I enjoy everything that you share, and very grateful to you for being on the show. And of course, everyone, you can check us out on Twitter and Facebook as well, and at WrestleSpective.com, where you'll get the newest podcasts and so on and so forth. And of course, check out our sponsor, RotoReels.com. So thanks everyone for listening, and we'll be back again later.